Welcome to our newly painted courtroom. You're the first people to argue under our new and improved colonial colors, thanks to Justice Ridgely's input. And you're supposed to tell us you really like it. And we're ready to hear argument in Carlson v. State. Are you ready to proceed?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Nicole Walker, and I represent Mr. Dennis Carlson. There are two issues before the Court today that are related. The first is whether Mr. Carlson's right to due process was violated when the State was permitted to put on a legal expert to define the term security as contained in the Delaware Securities Act. And the second issue is whether that term as contained in the Delaware Securities Act is, in fact, vague. We submit the answers to both of those questions is yes.
Ms. Walker, one of the things we'd like you to start out with is the standard of review. The way I read the briefs, everyone agrees this is plain error. And you just need to know that what you're saying to our court is, even though no one objected to this when it occurred, what happened was so egregious that it should constitute reversible error. And if we look at the expert, for example, in the exchange and the record, there seems to be some suggestion about, I'm concerned about this one expert, but I'm not concerned about the other expert. And then, in the worst-case scenario, if this turned into a Rule 61 motion, those are the types of exchange where, under Strickland, we say, well, that looks like strategy. And I only say that so that you'll know, in the back of our mind, when the standard of review is plain error, you really have to demonstrate that, notwithstanding the fact everybody let this occur, we should find it was reversible error.
Yes, Your Honor, and I did recognize that as the major hurdle in this case. And as I think I pointed out in the brief, it is because everybody, all the players, recognized that the term security was so unclear that it should have been apparent on the face from the judge's point of view as well as defense counsel's and the state's that this was impermissible. It is true that the defense counsel initially objected, and I believe he objected to the other expert and not necessarily this one. He then said, you know, I'm going to withdraw the objection based on strategy, and the court can determine based on the actual conversation with the court as to what the meaning of that is. My concern here for Mr. Carlson is I don't believe there was any waiver of his substantial right to due process. I don't think he made a knowing and intelligent waiver here. It is the defendant's right to waive it, not the attorney's. So while it may be a strategy decision cannot be a waiver of a right that the defendant has. For example, there are certain rights to testify or not testify that the attorney cannot waive. The defendant himself must do that. And while we were not there and we were not privy to the actual conversation between the defense counsel and his client, it is apparent from the conversations that took place at sidebar that such an issue was not even addressed as far as the actual nature of this individual's testimony.
Well, even if there was no waiver in the constitutional sense, as Justice Holland pointed out, it's still your side's burden to show that the error was so egregious that it deprived your client of a fair trial and that the result would be different.
Yes, Your Honor.
But for the error.
Well, I believe that as many state courts, federal courts, and in fact courts in this state have noted, that when a witness instructs the jury versus the trial court, that is a substantial error and that is egregious. There was another expert who testified as to the norms and standards in the banking industry. However, in this case, the judge instructed the jury based solely on parroting solely the language of the security definition. And I apologize, in my brief, I think I identified that as subsection 10 of 7302, and it's actually subsection 17. But she actually just quoted that. And given the nature of the testimony by the expert, What he said is almost contrary to what was parroted in the statute. So the jury would be substantially confused as to what to follow. For example, the expert said you have to follow Marine Bank versus Weaver to determine.
Well, which of your two arguments are you making now?
I'm sorry. The first issue with respect to the due process being violated by the legal expert testifying, and in fact, when he testified, he said, "Look, the statute's not clear on its face. Sometimes CDs are securities, sometimes they're not. So you can't look just to the statute. You have to follow this test," which he quoted as being the rule of law of Marine Bank. Now, it's clear from the other case that I cited, Bailey versus Texas, that reasonable minds disagree as to whether his conclusion that all offshore CDs are securities is actually correct. So he states this version of the law that was not argued to the court. The court then did not instruct the jury. So they hear from the expert witness, who is a Harvard graduate, had all these wonderful credentials that were cited to the jury, and they have in their mind, hey, this guy knows what he's talking about. He obviously knows what securities law is. So even though the judge said, here's the definition of securities, then they had in their mind, okay, do we then follow what the expert says as far as what the case law is? And no judge made the determination that in fact, was what the case law was.
Well, I'm trying to follow whether you're making another argument now. Are you taking exception to the judge's instructions?
No, Your Honor. I think that the instruction actually just bolsters the prejudice in this case and shows how the jury would have been confused in this case.
Do you agree that the judge instructed the jury in a manner that was accurate?
I believe what she did state was accurate. It was not complete if one were to look at the expert's testimony. And while I understand that you don't have the right
well,
to...
Well, let's not look... Apart from the expert's
yes.
testimony, let's assume the expert didn't testify. Was the instruction complete and a fair statement of the applicable law?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And then that would lead us to the vagueness issue, which is if the jury were then to just follow what the judge stated... it's vague. I mean, the court, the state, defense attorney, and all three, two attorneys and one expert testified. It's not clear. So if we were to look then just to the court's jury instruction, then the statute's vague on it as applied to Mr. Carlson. Because everybody knew it was confusing, and yet Mr. Carlson is an insurance salesman who arguably was very naive when it comes to this, thought he knew more than he did, was supposed to divine, okay, this says certificates of interest, but that must mean offshore CDs, not onshore CDs. So when we're looking at this and the fact that the witness was allowed to testify, as he did, it's clear that it did not assist the trier of fact in this case, and that's what the chancellor noted in In re Walt Disney Company recently in that litigation. And in that case, the chancellor said, you know, a law professor can't testify as to the fiduciary duties of directors. And unfortunate in this case is the fact that this was not raised ahead of time by defense counsel, because the three cases in Delaware, Walt Disney, North American, and Hodges, it appears they were all motions in limine where the court made a finding ahead of time, or at least before the individual testified. And in all three of them, parroted law that's been cited over and over again by several circuits that he cannot testify as to the conclusion of law.
Your two arguments seem to be at war with each other.
How's that, Your Honor?
If I understand your argument correctly, if there were no lawyer expert testimony, then according to the answer that you gave to Justice Ridgely, the court's instruction to the jury would not be problematic. Except that's what you said. You also said that it would be problematic because all that the instruction amounted to in this case was to parrot the language of the statute, which is vague.
Well,
so
I think,
is it adequate or not?
I think what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that the instruction and the expert testimony competed with each other. And the jury had to determine what to follow. The judge's instruction was accurate. I'm not arguing that was improper instruction. What I'm saying is the jury.
How could the instruction be proper if it simply recited the language of the statute, which you say is unconstitutionally vague?
Well, Your Honor, I guess what I'm saying is it was a correct statement of the law. It may not have been complete. If in fact, Mr. Griffin was correct, we'll assume for a minute his opinion was the correct conclusion, then the judge's instruction is not complete. To the extent that she was permitted, she gave the jury, this is what the statute says, that is correct. But if he is also correct, then yes, perhaps she should have gone on to say, now in determining whether this is a security, then what needs to happen is, assuming that you determine that this is an offshore CD, then you must find that it's a security based on the case law that the expert cited. Does that answer?
So would that direct a verdict of conviction or guilty? Is that essentially what you're saying the judge should have said?
Well, if that's equivalent of what Mr. Griffin said, so yes, that's what would have happened. And in fact, that demonstrates the prejudice of the expert's testimony, because he actually then directed the jury as to what the instruction is. If I'm not making myself clear,
I can't resist asking your first argument, as it appears in your brief, is the trial court violated Carlson's right to a fair trial when it permitted the state to introduce a Harvard-educated attorney's legal opinion on the term security.
Right.
Would that argument be the same if this lawyer expert were educated at some other institution?
No, Your Honor. What I was just pointing out was the fact that that in and of itself, it coupled with, his drafting legislation, his being on several securities agencies, his being part of the U.S. House of Representatives subcommittee, and thrown in there for good measure, they mentioned that he had worked for then-Governor Clinton, all of that to persuade the jury, hey, this guy knows what he's talking about when it comes to the law. I think because he was a legal expert, then the jury may or may not have listened to what the court had to say, because the court is to be the only legal expert. He has that right for the court
to be. What did the court say in that regard? Did the court say anything? You are to apply the law as I instruct it to the facts as you find them?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, isn't the jury presumed to follow that instruction?
Yes. However, again, when you have competing experts in the courtroom, the jury is being required then to make a conclusion of the law itself. I understand that's the general presumption, but I think this is a different case, because I think that when you have, it's like having two judges in the courtroom telling them different things, essentially. One telling them, this is the law, and the other one saying, yeah, that's the law, but you also need to do this and this and this.
Let's change it to a situation where someone is charged with an ethical violation and you're having a hearing and there's a code of conduct for lawyers, or we'll make it apples and apples, so it's lawyers. Experts testify all the time about ethical rules and ethical standards.
Yes, that's correct, and I think a couple of the cases that the state cited, that was similar a situation, and that's a different case, because what they're doing in that case is they're testifying as to process, not to the applicable law. They're saying, lawyers, accountants in medical cases as well, these are the steps that the attorney should have followed, not the ultimate conclusion of, based on him not following those steps, this is then a violation. The one example, since I deal with drug cases a lot, that I could think of was possession with intent to deliver. Usually a police officer takes a stand as an expert to say what intent is. And what he doesn't get up there and say, ladies and gentlemen, the law of the state of Delaware is that under Klein versus State and various other case laws, that if the state presents quantity, packaging, and an expert, then they can establish intent. He doesn't say that. He says, based on my training experience, I have found that drug dealers usually carry a weapon. They usually have a big rock for breakoff. They usually have several baggies. That allows the defendant then to attack them and say, well, personal users also have this and this and this. And then the judge instructs them and says what the law is under Klein versus State. You can assume, presume that this is intent. And I think that's the difference here. I don't think that Mr. Griffin said, testified to the, and Mr. Kerr did, but he didn't testify as to the standards and norms to allow the defendant to then counter that and for the judge to say, now you need to find if the Grenadine regulations are not as strict as the federal regulations, that there are securities. Now, she may or may not have instructed that based on a legal argument that should have been made to her regarding the instructions.
Sure. Just to make it very clear, in an ideal situation in the world that you say should have existed, what should the judge have instructed the jury to avoid this appeal?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know.
What's the answer?
well,
how are we?
In the perfect world, what would have happened was the defense counsel and the state would have said to the judge, look, we need to decide the instruction for security here. She should have made a conclusion as to the law herself. So when I said, I don't know, it depends on what conclusion she reached. She could have reached the same conclusion Mr. Griffin did, or she could not have. But let's assume she did. Then her instruction should have been that laid out the statute and then said, as I indicated, that, you know, if she's making a determination that the correct conclusion of Marine Bank is that all offshore CDs are securities, then she would have said that. Now, there would have been...
What would the jury have had to decide?
Well, I don't think she should, you know, I'm kind of making it more simple than it is. She wouldn't have actually said, if it's offshore CDs, then boom. I think that if that were the correct finding, the correct legal conclusion, then obviously the jury would have returned the same verdict. But my point is, in Bailey versus Texas, that court said, no, that's not the correct conclusion. So that's why there needed to be legal argument here, because she totally could have researched this, been presented with argument, and said, no, that is not the correct application of the law. The correct application of the law is that it depends on the individual country's regulations. It is not a per se rule that offshore CDs are all securities.
I don't want to interrupt you. You have 2.5 minutes left that you reserved. Do you want to continue or do you want to keep your 2.5 minutes?
I'll go ahead and keep the 2.5 minutes then. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the states. This case is a pretty straightforward case. Mr. Carlson was found guilty of 28 counts of selling an unregistered security and one count of selling securities by an unregistered agent. The state had the burden to prove every element of the crime. That included a willful sale of a security that was not registered and not exempt from registration. To that end, the state called two experts, Mr. Kerr and Mr. Griffin, to assist the jury to understand why the instruments being sold by Mr. Carlson were not exempt from registration. And
were securities.
Yeah, that they were securities. Although, the testimony was really designed to show that it was not, that they were exempt, not, that it was clear on the face of the statute, pretty much, that they were securities. Whether or not they were exempt is an additional element.
How is it clear in the face of the statute?
Because the statute says that stock is a security. Most of the counts were in fact stock. Nine of the counts included certificates of deposit, certificates of deposit for security are listed in the statute in the definition of security. They also, the state was had presented evidence that would meet a Howey test for security. So the state, in calling these experts, was anticipating a defense that these were exempt securities because of the Marine Bank situation, the possibility that having another regulatory agency in a foreign country that would be sufficient to show that these were could be exempt under the law.
So you're arguing, among other things, that to the extent that this is an indictment, a multi-count indictment.
Yes.
Charged Mr. Carlson with selling unregistered stock. There's no statutory vagueness there because the statute says that stock is a security.
Absolutely.
And likewise for the charged sales of unregistered CDs.
It does say certificates of deposit for a security. If that isn't, that to me would indicate that certificates of deposit are clearly securities, also read in light of the exemptions that state that the aforementioned securities are exempt. Listing certificate of deposit makes it pretty clear that certificates of deposit, unless exempt, are securities.
Well, can you think of another situation where someone's charged with a violation of the law and you would present expert testimony to explain the law?
Well,
For cocaine, someone's charged with possessing cocaine, and there's a statute that says you can't possess cocaine. Toxicologist says it's cocaine. Now, here they say you can't do these things under the securities law, but some things are exempt. And normally you would expect someone to give factual testimony about the characteristics of the item in question. And then based on those factual representations concerning the nature of the instrument, the jury would hear from the judge, here's a security, here's what's exempt, you've heard these facts, you need to decide whether this person sold a security and whether or not it was exempt. Now, why do we need an expert?
In this case, the expert was testifying had reviewed the documents at issue and was able to testify that although these were unusual in their terms, they could be categorized as certificates of deposit and as preferred stock, and that they would not be exempt based on the common understanding of what those instruments were.
All right, but help us draw the line. Let's suppose there was a timely objection in this case, and the objection had been something to the effect, I object, the proffer has the expert testifying about something that's within the province of the jury, and therefore, for the same reasons that the expert was excluded in Disney, you can't testify concerning an ultimate factual determination that the trier of fact has to make. This person should be excluded. Why wasn't this expert doing that?
Well, he wasn't testifying as to the ultimate fact in terms of whether Mr. Carlson was guilty. He was testifying as to whether particular instruments, in his opinion, were securities.
And securities or certificates of deposit and preferred stock?
Well, he testified that they're about the similarities that the documents had and the dissimilarities that they had to certificates of deposit and preferred stock. And he categorized those as evidence of indebtedness and also testified that he believed they were certificates of deposit to the substance. He was testifying as to the substance of what those.
But did he also go further?
He
went characterized further. Those instruments as securities that were not exempt.
He testified that, in his opinion, they were securities.
He was also citing case law, right?
Yes, he was.
Well, why do you have to do that if it's a factual matter.
He probably didn't need to do that. It was in anticipation of a defense that was ultimately not raised, which was that these were exempt. The state, in an abundance of caution, believed that it was the state's burden in a criminal case to show that the exemption did not apply.
But you focused on a distinction that we've dealt with in other cases. And there's a difference between the state's burden in establishing its case and anticipating a defense. And we've said many times the state should not be anticipating defenses. It should leave that for rebuttal.
Yes. Certainly the exemption part would more properly have come in rebuttal.
But now, what we have is a record where it's come in, and the argument on appeal is this may be a plain error case, but if you look at the record in this case, it was so hopelessly confused that really it wasn't a fair trial. And it got hopelessly confused because we had an expert testifying about factual determinations the jury should have made, and we had an expert testifying about an anticipated defense that never materialized.
I would point out that this was, in fact, waived. It was not just plain error, but it was a waived situation. In fact, defense counsel stated that his client had instructed him to withdraw the objection. So in that case, any error that was there, I believe, was entirely waived.
Can you waive plain error?
The court doesn't need to reach the issue when it's been absolutely waived by the at trial.
Was there contrary expert testimony or only expert testimony adduced by the state?
There was no contrary expert testimony. The jury was instructed, regarding expert witnesses, and that they were to judge them as any other witness. And they were given the correct jury instructions. There was no need to instruct further because the exemption issue was not argued.
What was the defense's argument before the jury?
The defense argued had a three-pronged defense in their closing argument and noted that the sale did not occur in Delaware was the one, that Mr. Carlson was not an agent but an independent contractor, and that his mistake of fact regarding whether these were securities that needed to be registered negated his willful state of mind.
So there was no argument that these weren't securities or that these were securities but exempt. Just that he made a mistake. In other words,
exactly.
They conceded, or his counsel virtually conceded that they were non-exempt securities, but argued that Mr. Carlson didn't know that.
Yes. In fact, when asked, the defense counsel stated there was no question that these were securities and that the exemption did not apply. When the court asked, well, if you're conceding, why are we having expert testimony if you're conceding that these are securities? And defense counsel said, I'm not conceding that, which left the state believing that he was not conceding that, and continued to put the experts on, and the court understood that to be the situation. And it was in the same general conversation with the court that defense counsel stated that he waived the objection.
Waived it or withdrew it?
He stated that he withdrew the objection on the instruction of his client.
So is it fair to infer from that the defendant wanted this expert to testify for strategic reasons?
Yes, and in fact it fit in well with the defense strategy, which throughout the trial was attempting to show that Mr. Carlson was very gullible, that he was really one of a victim, not a criminal, and that he had been convinced that these were legitimate investments, and he was naive, and he was... So the defense, in fact, made a point of crossing the expert to bring out more information about law, and also to show that this was a very confusing area of the law, so it would be legitimate for his client, for the defendant, to have misunderstood whether or not what he was selling was a security.
So if it's error or plain error, is it something that was waived?
I believe it was waived, Your Honor.
So is it your position that plain error can be waived?
Yes. It was not a forfeited by oversight. It was clearly waived in the situation. It played into the defense, and there was certainly no substantial problem with the trial. There was no prejudice to him. He used these experts to his to assist in his defense argument. So to that end, the state would contend there's no prejudice and there's no need to address the issue at all. As to the vagueness argument, the securities definition is very similar to the same definition in many other states. 37 to 38 states in the country have based their securities laws on the Uniform Securities Act of 1956. Many states have addressed this issue. No one has found it yet to be vague. And as applied to Mr. Carlson in particular, he was a licensed insurance broker. He was working under a cease and desist order, which had been in fact given an explanation as to what constituted a security, which he chose to ignore. The evidence showing that he was clearly putting out blind ads, 800 numbers without his name, denying advertising, denying that he was selling any investments other than insurance, would indicate that he was quite aware of what he was doing. So as to him, he certainly understood that the instruments that he was selling were securities, and he may have been mistaken as to whether they were exempt. However, he was given information as to how to contact the Securities Commissioner's office to find out if there was any doubt, and the definition of a security had been explained to him very clearly at the time. So the state does not believe there's any constitutional problem with the securities statute, and
assuming
certainly not.
Assuming we find that it was plain error for the expert to testify on the law, is that harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or would there be a reversal required?
The state would contend it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Why?
Because it was actually those items, the instruments were securities. There's no question by reading the statute. The jury was instructed as to what a security is. They listened to the description of the documents, their similarities to other things. They were able to make a factual finding, and Mr. Carlson was not prejudiced in any way by that. So the state would contend ultimately that any error, it was harmless, and the state would say that the expert's testimony was not contrary to the statute, and there was an instruction that they could disregard the expert's testimony and certainly weigh it as any other witness other in ITEC, although this court found it to be error to have an expert testify as to conclusions of law. That was found to be no reversible error in that case, based in part on the court found it significant that there was no objection. Based on that, unless there are any more questions, state.
Thank you.
Honors, I'd like to address the waiver issue because I know that's, I think, the major hurdle here. The record in this case is what the court needs to look to determine whether or not it was a waiver of Mr. Carlson's right, a knowing, intelligent waiver. The discussions at sidebar, I think, are very significant here. Even the defense counsel and the state and I will double check to see if I put this in the appendix, but they in jest discussed viaticals and said, I don't know what a viatical is. Do you know what a viatical is? And that apparently is a an instrument which Mr. Carlson was allowed to sell, but as the prosecutor pointed out on direct exam, he's permitted to, in other jurisdictions, it's considered security.
Ms. Walker, the arguments you're making today have nothing to do, no relation to the arguments that were made by the defense at the trial. And so my question is, how could the waiver not be knowing? That is, counsel for Mr. Carlson wasn't giving up anything that mattered in terms of the arguments he was going to make to the jury.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor. I don't think that it was a mistake of fact argument that he didn't know it was security, but it was a security. The mistake of fact was he did not know the Attorney General was of the opinion that these were securities. He had been told by the Attorney General before that they were of the opinion, based on a Howey analysis, that promissory notes were securities. But he had never been told that they were of the opinion that these were securities. And it would be reasonable to suggest that, based on the other case law in other states, that would have been a reasonable conclusion, even based on the face of the statute. And the fact that this other case law was brought to the defense counsel's attention, actually at sidebar again by the prosecutor, also demonstrates that perhaps Mr. Carlson did not have all the information in front of him before he made this significant waiver. And the fact that, again, having two judges in the courtroom, regardless of what the issues are, I would also argue is in a superior courtroom.
Thank you very much.
It would hurt. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.
Please rise.